I think that it is not... I will start by, of course, doing the same thing that everyone has done so far, which is to thank Vidya and Kriti as well as all of those who have contributed to make these workshops such an interesting experience to all of us. At least it has been for me, and I wish to thank everyone who was involved in the organization of this meeting. I am going to ask for a little bit of understanding. I am trying to put in 50 minutes an experience that lasts about 4 decades. So I will go over, I selected the slides that I thought would be interesting for you to, let's say, take a look at, and at the same time have a flavor about what has happened during these decades that have been so important for experimental biology for a number of reasons. So please, if you, I'm sure that you will have objections to what I will say or show. So please take them, if possible, to the end after I finish. I am expected to finish in about 50 minutes or 60 at the most, so we'll have plenty of time for discussion. What I am going to talk about is something that we have distilled with Ana Soto for all those decades, and I wish to share with her the good things and bad things that I will say, especially the bad things. Okay, so I will start with some ideas about how I see the task that I have before me. And I will point out, I would like you to concentrate on the third part of the third definition that Francisco Ayala advanced in 1968. Because I believe that the explanatory hypothesis provided by science must be genuinely testable and therefore subject to the possibility of rejection. This is something that has not happened very often in biology. And then I am going to repeat something that Gianni and others have already mentioned, which is that to begin with, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, something that the Russians, this is the title of the article that he wrote in 1973, with which I don't fully agree with everything he says, but this is absolutely a great quote. Now, part of our experience has been translated into a book that we published in 1999 with Anna, and that was translated into French in 2006 without almost any, it was a postface that we added some data, but it remained almost untouched. Okay, so what we learned while reading writing the book was that some facts are not facts, but deeply rooted ideology, something that we have already heard from Jack in other words. More specifically, that wrong premises have been adopted regarding the default state of cells, and this relates to the ability to proliferate and to move. There have been two opposing views, one that considers that proliferation is the default state versus the prevalent one, which is that quiescence is the default state, and the same is true with motility. And the third thing that we learned was that the wrong hierarchical level of analysis can be used to explain carcinogenesis, and this conflicts between a cellular view and a tissular view, and in other words goes more deeply into the issue of reductionism versus organicism. Okay, so A lot of people have a vague idea about where is that carcinogenesis fits into life. And I will start from the very beginning, of course. There has been a so-called prebiotic soup, and somehow, and we don't know how, a cell was formed. And as you know, Charles Darwin, who was a very smart guy, refused to enter into this discussion because it is a can of worms that is still being open and not resolved. But the fact is that from this physical world, a biological world was created, and evolution has started up to about 2 minutes ago. Okay, so this is what went on before. Eventually, with evolution, unicellular organisms started to appear, seen, and out of eukarya, probably, multicellularity started, and cancer entered into the picture, meaning that, of course, neither bacteria, nor archaea, nor unicellular eukaryotes have cancer. Cancer appears when multicellular organisms appear. Okay, so then, just an aside, to introduce a subject that Albert already mentioned, but I want to go over it again. There is such a thing called the cell cycle that will allow one cell to go through a period of changes that eventually will end up at the end of mitosis with the formation of two cells. But there are two questions that are relevant to be asked, and they are, why do cells proliferate and how do cells proliferate? As I said, out of one cell, a whole thousands of, biochemical steps go on, and structural steps go on in order to form two cells. Now, if we want to know how the cells proliferate, we can analyze any or all of the steps that are necessary to produce out of one cell two cells. But instead, if we want to understand why the cells proliferate, we could concentrate on this phase in which from G0 we enter into G1. In other words, here is where the decision to enter the cycle takes place, and depending on your preconceived ideas, you can use stimulators to push the cell into the cycle, or you can use inhibitors to cancel in order to produce the entrance of the cell at this stage into the cycle. And then, of course, the end product in both cases is going to be the same, but the mechanism or the process whereby such a thing happens is significantly different. Okay, so this is an aside. We'll come back to this. But for those of you who are not familiar with cancer and what cancer is or is not, I would like you to consider the notion that people ask also, so what is cancer? So a neoplasm or cancers is in fact an altered tissue organization where there is less organism. This is the normal mammary gland, for example, and this is a tumor that comes from this normal mammary gland. So there is less organization but increased complexity. Neoplasms are diagnosed by pathologists, and only by pathologists who, using light microscope, accomplish what molecular biologists promised us, but so far has not delivered, using a number of omicses. Okay, so let's go back to history again, which is something that teaches where things started. Cancer is something that has been described in mummies in Egypt. But the issue became of interest starting with probably in the 50s, the 1850s, with Virchow, who was the pathologist of record at that time. And other pathologists, especially Rieber in Germany, considered cancer a tissue-based disease. I am going to touch on this probably in the discussion because it's not relevant to the cancer theorists per se. But it was then in 1914 that Theodore Boveri described for the first time an alternative to the notion that cancer was a tissue-based disease and proposed instead that cancer was a cell-based disease whereby chromatin had broken down and as a result cancer developed. And he was in fact the precursor of the so-called somatic mutation theory that I'm going to describe in a minute or so. But then in the 30s and 50s, Waddington and Needham and Orr came back to the notion that cancer was in fact a developmental disease, in other words, a tissue-based disease. It is undeniable that the molecular biology revolution that started in 1953 with the description of the structure of DNA was very important in the development of cancer theories. And some of the people who used or were part of the revolution took an attitude that Dennett called greedy reductionism, trying to, let's say, go to the lowest possible level in order to explain what cancer was. And this was, of course, taken up in the 60s and 70s by what was called the War on Cancer by President Nixon in the US. That increased the funding and the dominant paradigm at that time, that is the somatic mutation theory. That was, of course, also helped by the notions of oncogenes and suppressor genes. And then in 1999, we offered an alternative to these views. Not all cancers come with the same flavor. There are different types of cancers. And they mainly can be divided into big groups, the inborn errors of development that we have labeled that way, and the sporadic cancer. The sporadic cancers are the ones that probably us or people we know have going to or have suffered or died from. The inborn errors of development are a small minority so far, and they are, of two different provenance. One is what we call the inherited inborns of development, which are a small minority, less than 2% of the tumors that come to the clinic, and an increasing number of tumors of characteristics are what we call the induced inborns errors of development. And I put a question mark here and here because more and more cancers are being attributed to processes that happen during pregnancy. Okay, so let me explain to you what each of these cancers are about. The inherited inborns of development, that, as I said, are about 2%, are generated by mutated genes, gametes, that eventually will form an egg, and at the end of birth and during puberty ends up in the development of malformations and or tumors like retinoblastoma, Wilms, and others. And then we have the induced inborn errors of development that at this time are estimated to be about 10% of the total, but I again call to your attention the fact that there is this question mark that comes from normal gametes that form a normal egg, but during pregnancy, women are exposed to what we call endocrine disruptors, which was a subject that have occupied us for the last 25 years. As a result of these processes in which these disruptors affect target organs, tumors appear, as well as malformations, during early infancy and during puberty as well. And finally, we have the so-called sporadic cancers that used to be considered about 95% of the cancers, but they are coming down and down, in which normal gametes form a normal egg, But they are, during pregnancy, these embryos or fetuses are exposed to these carcinogenic agents that, on top of those that are appearing, or people suffer, especially during puberty, form the bulk of the tumors that we suffer for the most part. Okay. Now, there is another point I wish to make because it has been confusing, and that is the notion of causes versus explanations. We know the causes of most, if not all, the cancers. They are due to infections by viruses, exposure to radiation, environmental agencies, and inflammations. And you can see here, I listed the most common ones, and these are clearly causes of cancer. The fact that we know the causes doesn't mean that we know how to explain that the tumor has been developed as a result of these exposures. But the important thing that I believe is relevant, and I think that I miss... What I meant to say is this. Because we know the causes of cancer, we can do something about them, and as a result, we can, for example, as the Chinese have done, develop the vaccine against hepatitis viruses, or now, as you are probably aware, young women are exposed to vaccines of HPV and other viruses to prevent cervical cancers. We can reduce the exposure to radiation. Of course, we can reduce all these environmental agents that we are exposed to, and of course, we can treat, in the case of Helicobacter pylori with the antibiotic, these patients, and they are so-called, you eliminate the cause of the cancer, but you don't explain, in fact, how come that this has happened. For that, we have explanations, and the explanations are mainly these two. One in which people claim that all these causes affect the genome of a cell, and that is the attitude that the somatic mutation theory has adopted, and on the contrary, there is this other the theory that we have proposed. The crux of the matter is that somatic mutation theory is centered at the cellular, subcellular, and molecular levels of biological organization, while the tissue organization field theory is based or centered at the tissue level of biological organization. Okay, so far the description of the problem, and here comes the issue of how we interpret and evaluate the impact of these theories in biology at large. If we adopt quiescence as the default state cells in metazoa, in fact, and I'm sure that it's not intended, we are making a type of creationism out of this matter, because as I told you before, when the original cell was formed, there was probably no one around, and what happened was a phenomenon that we don't know how it happened, but eventually that cell was formed and didn't need any stimulation in order to start proliferating and justify, for example, the fact that we are here meeting today as a result of precisely the ability of that cell to proliferate and eventually vary and eventually form different species and different multicellular species and so on. This is as far as biology is concerned. And when we move into carcinogenesis, what we call normal development gone awry, the same epistemological criticism can be applied. I said that premises are premises. Premises don't have to be right premises. You have to build premises without knowing whether they are right Okay, so what is the somatic mutation theory about? What it claims is that quiescence is the default state of cells in metasoma, and that somatic mutations accumulate in a single epithelial cell in genes that putatively control cell proliferation and cell differentiation, or cell differentiation. I forgot to tell you that in that slide in which I mentioned that the why and the how, we have not been able to... the difference is that the how, the why is our answer. And it has nothing to do with what's going on inside the cycle. In other words, what's going on inside the cycle is irrelevant to the idea, to the fact that the decision has been taken by this cell, if it has a personality, to enter the cycle. In other words, you cannot explain the switching on by identifying a gene within that cell cycle that is responsible for anything that will happen, because this is like a washing machine in which you put the dishes, you turn on the switch, and at the end of a period, you get clean dishes. So it's an automatic thing that cannot, or if you wish to extrapolate to a car, when you in the morning you go to your lab, you don't open the hood and twinkle what is in the engine in order to make it start. You just turn on the key and it happens. Okay. Now, in graphic form, here is the single epithelial cell that is the target of the carcinogen. And again, the default state of metasoma cell is quiescence for this theory. The neoplastic phenotype is due to somatic mutations in the DNA of that cell. And obviously, this implies that tumors are clonal. Okay, the corollary, again, is that tumors are clonal, and that cancer cells proliferate autonomously, and cancer is irreversible. And this is what has been stated in a very highly quoted paper in Hallmark, entitled Hallmarks in Cancer, published in Cell. Okay, and this theory has never been tested to the best of my ability to read the literature. And we suggested that a way to test the somatic mutation theory would be, let's say, trying to cover that hole in this process of explaining cancer, would be to obtain the DNA of a single cell, mutate it, put it inside an enucleated cell, take that enucleated cell, and which is this engineer cell that has to survive, and then inject it into a site that the experimentalist can select, and eventually get the tumor, then take out the, get the tumor, extract the DNA, look for the mutated DNA that was originally injected into the cell. This is an impossible experiment to do today, because when you generate the sequence, you destroy the sequence. So it's impossible to do this experiment. But we see no other way to test the hypothesis. Okay, so now let's move to the theory that we propose, and that is the tissue organization theory, in which again the explicit premises are that the default state of cells, of all cells, is proliferation of motility, which is consistent with evolutionary theory, and that the targets are tissues. And by tissues, I mean this so-called normal tissue morphogenetic unit made up of epithelial cells and the stroma that lies underneath. And the carcinogen acts on this tissue in order to produce the tumor. The corollary of this is that cancer is a problem of tissue organization comparable to organ synergy. embryogenesis during development that gone awry. Something wrong has happened. One question or several questions that have been come up are thoughts about how it is that people have produced this theory of the somatic mutation theory. In other words, if proliferation is the default state of cells and you have maximal proliferation when you put cells in culture, how can you increase the rate of proliferation when you have already a maximal rate due to the fact that cells proliferate as a default? The second question that we have been searching for, or searching an answer for, is where is that data published or reproduced? And finally, are the phenotypes that are consistent with the notion of growth factors and oncogenes, which are the so-called stimulators, have a proliferative phenotype? And the answer, to the best of my ability to read the literature, is no. Okay, so it would be fair, nevertheless, despite these doubts, to raise the question how to resolve which is the theory that closer explains carcinogenesis. And the answer would be, the question would be, would it be possible to test the plausibility of either theory by designing an experimental protocol in which equal chances are given to both theories to be proven right, or one of them wrong,